From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. A gay man is brutally beaten after he leaves a Salt Lake City club. The same night, a group of men break into a Salt Lake apartment and assault another gay man. And two or three assailants yell gay slurs at an American Fork man before attacking him outside the salon where he works. It's been a very rough 3 weeks for Utah's gay community. Since the attacks, there have been vigils and fundraisers and workshops helping people to process the violence. But unsettling questions remain. Are these isolated incidents or part of a wave of anti-gay feeling? And how long will it take for LGBT Utahns to feel safe again? Today on the program, responding to gay bashing in Utah. Plus, uncovering what Utahns value. A new quality of life index is unveiled. All that plus your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Earlier this summer, supporters of same-sex marriage cheered when New York legislators voted to legalize same-sex marriage in that state. And recent polls have shown that a majority of Americans now approve of same-sex marriage. But the last few weeks have been a reality check for Utah's LGBT community. A string of beatings and attacks on gay men has LGBT leaders worried about an uptick in hate crimes and safety issues. Will the incidents result in changes in behavior and attitudes? And how should the larger community respond to the recent violence? Today on the program, we're talking about gay bashing in Utah. Now what? Joining us this hour, Michael Aaron. He's owner and publisher of Q Salt Lake, a biweekly LGBT magazine. And Michael Aaron, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also in studio, Lee Dabrowski. He is deputy chief of the Salt Lake City Police Department. Thanks to you, deputy.
Thank you.
And we invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments. Have the recent attacks affected how safe you feel? The number to call, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Michael Aaron, I want to start with you. Your magazine broke the Dane Hall story as well as the piece on Cameron Nelson, the man from American Fork. Just briefly recap for us the details of these three attacks and how you heard about the stories.
Sure. Dane has said that he was followed by, or he was walking across the street. And was and heard an anti-gay epithet directed at him, he believed, and suddenly found himself across the street and hit behind the head, and then subsequently curb checked, and basically passed out at that point. And from there, it was kind of a mishmash of details, which obviously a victim of a crime is has a very difficult time. Recalling exact details. So that case came to us because we happened to have seen a photo he put up on Facebook of his injuries, and we reached out to him and asked him what happened, and it took several days for him to feel comfortable enough to talk to us.
Sure. You also talked about Cameron Nelson. You reported that story. Briefly again, tell us what happened there.
That case, the victim had gone out with some friends and had returned to his workplace. And while he was taking out the trash, a group of men, somewhere between two and three men, again yelled anti-gay epithets at him. And attacked him to the point where he has a broken nose.
And there was another incident in Salt Lake City, a man attacked in his boyfriend's apartment.
Right. And the victim's story is that he was in his boyfriend's apartment on the couch, and some people came into the apartment and attacked him, and he and followed him out of the building. And he hailed down a passing car.
Deputy Chief Dabrowski, you've been with the City Police Department for a decade now. Can you put these recent attacks in some kind of context? What is the larger picture of violence in the city?
Actually, two decades. Let me throw that in there.
All right.
But
didn't want to demote you there.
No. The larger picture of violence in Salt Lake City We actually are right now at a 25-year low in violent crime in Salt Lake City. And as I told you before we started, we actually, it could be more than 25 years. We just don't trust the statistics prior to that 25-year period. Not to minimize what is occurring right now, but that overall Salt Lake City is very safe.
So are these hate crimes? I know that the law is very specific here in Utah about what a hate crime is. So maybe you can give us a definition of what a hate crime is.
What we do is when we get a report of a crime, regardless of the race, gender, orientation of a victim, we investigate them all the same way to begin with, because they're in our eyes, no victim is different than any other victim. We put the same amount of effort forth investigating that crime. As the investigations develop, then we determine whether or not there was something that qualifies as a hate crime that was the motivating factor. And so in these particular cases, they're still under investigation. And we are in the process of determining whether or not they are, in fact, hate crimes by law, by the legal definition.
Michael Aaron, after your stories broke, I'm just wondering what kind of response you got at the magazine and what other people were telling you about how these attacks affected them.
Sure. The community has really had an outpouring of support and help for all of these victims. And there's a mixture of... We didn't think this happened anymore. We thought, you know, here we are now in 2011, and, you know, we thought this was all over. On the other side of that, we know that this happens all the time, and now we're finally just hearing that we've had a smattering of people actually report these crimes. So there's been both of those cases. Personally, I'm hoping for the former.
Deputy Chief, Sully City Police Chief Chris Burbank has made several appearances over the last couple of weeks at clubs and other gatherings, kind of reassuring that police will vigorously prosecute any leads that they have on hate crimes and violent assaults. Can you reiterate what the police department is doing in terms of trying to make people feel safe in the community?
Absolutely. Chief Burbank has made a number of appearances. In fact, on Friday night, this past Friday, a number of us, including myself, went to the vigil at Liberty Park and the walk that accompanied that vigil. And then we went down to a club to talk to members of the LGBT community to try and reassure them, to let them know, but also to try and motivate members of this community to reach out to us. What we have found, for example, in the Dane Hall case, it happened in a very public place. However, we have had no witnesses call us and say, this is what I saw. And it's very concerning to us that something that happened in such a public place, that no one is willing to come forward and tell us if they saw anything, what they saw. And so we've been trying to reach out. I had great conversation with a number of members of the community, but trying to tell them, you know, that they expressed concern about calling the police, which was disheartening to me. However, I tried to, you know, we all tried to reassure them that regardless of which community you're a member of, we're all a member of the Salt Lake community, and that we as the police department are here to protect you, to investigate what's happened to you, and to prosecute anybody who has committed a crime.
From what you're hearing, are you hearing that people are satisfied with an answer like that? Do they feel like, yes, I can go to the police and report something that has happened to me or a friend or whatever?
You know, there is a lot of frustration in the community, and I think the frustration is trying to find someone to blame for all of this. And yes, when this first came out, both the police departments and the media were both being kind of villainized for not having found something sooner. I think efforts that the police department have been making are definitely making strides in at least appeasing people's feelings that the police department are dragging their feet on this. Really, it ends up being a slew of circumstances that these cases didn't move forward faster.
And I know that you can't give us a lot of specifics, Deputy Chief, on the investigation, but can you give us anything on both the Dane Hall case as well as the other who was beaten in his apartment.
Well, as and you're right, I can't give you a whole lot because just like any other investigation, when it's ongoing, there's very little we can release so that we don't taint an investigation. However, as I said on Friday night, one of our big pushes, we went through the entire club area. We had numerous officers, our bike officers and other officers, trying to track down and trying to find witnesses to help us corroborate, to point out suspects. But we tried to let people know that even if you're uncomfortable calling the police, which I would like to in any way dispel that there's a concern about calling the police. You know, we are here to help everyone in this community, but we have given them the option of we have a new program. It's on our website, slcpd.com, that you can put in anonymous tips via your smartphone. And that way that anybody, even if they have a concern about us, they can call us, they can give us an anonymous tip to try and follow up on this investigation so that we can bring whoever has committed this act to justice.
But again, just to repeat, you don't have any leads at this point, particularly in the Dane Hall case.
I didn't say no leads. What I said was we haven't had witnesses come forward, and we are trying to get someone out there who saw it, be it on a tracks train, driving by, walking by, someone to assist us in this investigation.
Okay. Deputy Chief Lee Dabrowski of the Salt Lake City Police Department, thanks very much for your time this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invitation.
And Michael Aaron is with us, owner and publisher of Q Salt Lake, a biweekly LGBT magazine. We're going to continue with him after the break. Today on the program, we're talking about preventing violence toward gays in Utah. And we invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments. How are you thinking about the recent beatings of three gay men in the state? 801-355-TALK is our number. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pearson. This is City Views. Today on the program, we're talking about gay bashing and where we as a community go from here. If you've got questions or comments, give us a call, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And joining me now, Michael Aaron, owner and publisher of Q Salt Lake, a biweekly LGBT magazine. And joining us now, Brandy Bolkin is Executive Director of Equality Utah. Brandy, thanks so much for coming in. As well as M. Yashde, she is the Youth Program Director of the Inclusion Center for Community and Justice at Westminster College. And M., thanks to you. So let's start with Brandy Bolkin. Deputy Chief Lee Dabrowski, he touched on what a hate crime is. Mm-hmm. There was an article, a column in this morning's Salt Lake Tribune by the columnist Peg McEntee, who says that Utah's hate crime law is weak. Maybe you can expand on that.
Well, I think we've heard that frequently with the statute that protects victims of hate crimes or that allows prosecution to enhance penalties for hate crimes. And as far as I'm aware, our hate crime statute has never been enforced within the state of Utah. That many prosecutors see it as incredibly difficult to find a case that is prosecutable under the hate crime statute.
And why is that?
Well, I think that it has to do with what the intent is, the intent to intimidate or to harass. And I think that any act of aggression, obviously there's an intention to intimidate or to strike fear or to threaten. And again, it's the enhanced penalty. You know, you can't prosecute as a hate crime. What you can do is enhance the penalty on the back end. So that's one piece of our hate crime statute. I would say, too, that as a community member, I think that one of the things that our statute is missing is actually addressing bias that causes people to do acts of aggression based on bias. So if someone commits an act of aggression and they do it because they have a bias against a specific person or a group of people, enhancing their punishment penalty is not going to address the core issue of bias or the core issue of discrimination, right? I think that we have an opportunity right now as a community to talk about really addressing these core issues of bias and how we begin to humanize everyone in our community. Because that's really what, as I see it, that's what the core issue is. If you're able to dehumanize someone so much through your bias that it's okay in your mind to hurt them in that way, then we need to address that problem. You know, this sort of ability to dehumanize to the point that there's no respect for their core value, there's no respect for their dignity or their humanity.
Deputy Chief Lee Dabrowski of the Salt Lake PD, he mentioned that we actually in the city are experiencing a 25-year low in crime rates and mm-hmm. violent crime. Mm-hmm. Does that make your community feel any better, Brandy Balkin?
Well, I would say that, and Em and I were talking actually outside the studio before we came in, and I can say without a doubt that the impact of these three incidents has certainly struck fear into the hearts of many LGBT people. All you have to do is go on Facebook or have a conversation internally within the community, and you know that people are afraid. People do feel like they are being targeted. That's something, I mean, what I hear over and over again is what is going on. So it certainly had the impact of creating fear within the community. And I do think that Salt Lake City is a safe city. I think that Utahns as a whole are kind and good-hearted people with goodwill in their hearts. But I think that at this moment, statistics are not calming the sense of fear and panic.
M. Yashde from the Inclusion Center at Westminster College. What are you hearing from people about this recent spate of attacks?
I'm hearing a lot of what Brandy is talking about, a lot of fear. We were discussing, I think considering the low crime rate, I think there's almost a sense of, well, is that one person going to be me? Is it me? Amongst our queer community, our LGBT community, there's a lot of questions about whether or not they are now in danger and if they should be watching their backs. And it's just a really scary time for them. Mm-hmm. A lot of concern.
So the fact that the police department is reaching out, mm-hmm. is attending vigils, is going to clubs, is that satisfying at all, or at least a little bit comforting? Michael Aaron?
I think people are seeing that with the new presence of the police department within the clubs and when they're out, I think that is a calming feeling. I think there is also, however, a lot of this is happening now. What will happen here in another 6 weeks? Is this all going to be going away? Mm-hmm. Personally, I have seen that there are some new things that have been going on, like the area around some of these clubs are better lit. And I know that there's a new mantra in the community to make sure that you do not go out, leave these clubs inebriated by yourself, especially.
Michael Aaron, as you mentioned earlier, that some had criticized the media for not responding and publishing more quickly. Elaborate on that, if you would.
And really, that just did happen because of a number of different things that kind of failed. The original 911 call that was made, and especially in Dane's case, there was no follow-up on that, largely because he refused medical service. And it breaks my heart that he did that because he'd had no insurance and couldn't afford the ambulance ride. And so he was taken to the hospital on his own. I think there were some failures at the hospitals. There should have been some kind of victim's advocate at a hospital that this was a victim of a crime, obviously, that should have been reported. He did report the crime once he woke up Saturday evening. And this did not make it into the media reports that the police department puts out. There were just a number of small things that added up to this just didn't – this was almost lost.
Hmm. Brandy Balkin, though, I mean – it's interesting to me that there is such a high awareness, I think, right now, probably mm-hmm. higher than ever, of gay, lesbian issues. Mm-hmm. According to the latest census, there are over 5,800 same-sex couples in Utah. Salt Lake City School District, other government agencies are offering partner benefits. So how do you put this recent violence in some kind of context?
Well, I think you've asked a really great question, and I think that that's what the community is struggling with. It's really difficult to put it into context. We have a community that is is that has worked very, very hard for a very long time, not just in the state of Utah, but across the country to, again, create common ground, to establish our common humanity. And I think that we have seen, as you open the show with, you know, we've seen increased acceptance and understanding of what it is to be lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. We've seen a much greater sense of overall community investment in the greater good and acceptance of LGBT people. And then you have these incidents, and it does seem like things have been flipped over a little bit. I think that that's, you identify a key piece that the community is really struggling with, and that is, why is this happening now? Is this indicative of some deeper community sentiment? There's a lot of confusion and a lot of concern about if this is a greater indicator of some kind of future trend, or if this is, you know, some horrible random string of incidents that are just happening right now, and nobody really knows the answer to that. I think we're all kind of struggling to figure that out.
I'm glad I'm not the only one who's confused. We're talking about the recent spate of gay bashings in Utah. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. So what are some of the strategies, M. Yashde, of putting violence behind us? How do we move forward?
I think that's a complicated question, because I think to move forward, I think we also have to start back at the beginning, at least in the work of the Inclusion Center. You know, our famous bumper sticker is "Nobody's born a bigot," and the idea is that we don't wake up one day and decide to go and beat someone up, but instead we learn these things in our classrooms, from our community members in the streets, on the TV. And so I think for us, it's really about, one, trying to make sure that we're supporting those people who have been hurt, and then trying to have that dialogue with the LGBT community in Salt Lake City, but also continuing our work with young children, making sure that they feel safe, making new friends, or working with high school students to say, you know, it's okay to sit with a different person at lunch, and just continually having these conversations to remind people that we are all human.
Mm-hmm. Is this somehow commentary on the larger community, though? The way that the hospital didn't respond right away, the police department didn't respond as you would like them to immediately. Does this have something to say about who we are as a local culture?
I think there is a lot of room for understanding each other a lot better. There is a project going on right now called Pink Dot Utah that does address that very head-on. If you know somebody who's gay or lesbian, bisexual or transgender, are you reaching out to that person to say, hey, I believe that you are an important part of this community? A lot of fear about, for especially kids, male kids especially, standing up for other gay and gay and lesbian people because they might be thought of as gay. Mm-hmm. But to actually stand up and have the courage to do so in the face of that. So this campaign is culminating October 11th at the Spring Mobile Ballpark, where people will wear pink shirts and come together and support the community and show that they are very supportive of this community. And we're hoping for a lot of people to make a big statement in Utah that this is something we do not accept.
Hmm. Jennifer, if I could, though, I think it would be tough to say that what happened at the hospital was a reflection of Dane being a gay man or what happened. You know, I don't think we can draw those conclusions at this point. I think that that's the other piece that I feel is incredibly important, is for us to let this process continue forward so that we can get all the information that we need. When you have incidents like this that occur, we all want to know what happened right now. We want to know all the details. We want to know why this happened, why this didn't happen, where, you know, all the pieces. We want all the pieces to fall into place so that we can understand the story. And unfortunately, we don't know all the pieces at this point. I think Michael mentioned, you know, we have somebody who has some traumatic head wounds. And, you know, it's really difficult to know all the pieces in each of these three incidents at this point. I think that the very best that we can do is to support these people who were the victims of violence, to give them the space that they need to heal. And I think we also need to support each other within the community. And I'm not just speaking about supporting people who are LGBT. I mean, Jennifer, we know that there are many communities that are targeted for violence based on their real or perceived characteristics. This doesn't just happen to LGBT people. Violence is not just an issue for LGBT people. And I think that, again, there's an opportunity for us right now to really start talking about dignity, treating with people with respect, talking about treating people as full human beings and participants in our community. And I think that as opposed to just digging for the details about these incidents, I think there's a chance for us to be a little bit self-reflective and say, okay, who are we as a culture? And what do we tolerate and what don't we tolerate? And how do we want to be? And then we need to start being that way.
You know, I think to me, what you're saying is kind of almost symptomatic of what it means to be part of a marginalized population, because there's a sense of paranoia and around every turn. Did this happen because I'm whatever it may be? So when we talk about the hospital response to the police or when the media found out, it all culminates, and I think it leads to this kind of generalized community paranoia. Is it because we're gay? But I think what Brandy's saying is really valid, that while the paranoia and that fear is completely a valid emotion, we really have to take a step back and kind of calm ourselves and say we need to wait for the details to come out. We can't just, you know, jump in there and start making assumptions just because now we're afraid. So it's a difficult place to be in.
We're talking about gay bashing in Utah. Michael Aaron is with us, owner and publisher of Q Salt Lake. Brandy Balkin is executive director of Equality Utah, and Amit Yashde is with the Inclusion Center for Community and Justice at Westminster College. Yes, the fear is legitimate, but I guess, is that altering the way that people in the LGBT community are acting now? Is it going to affect how people choose to dress? Is it going to affect how people live their lives, if they stay out late or they go home early? Do they travel in packs? Michael Aaron, what do you think?
I can say yes, because, I mean, even myself, I was leaving the office very late last night, and I'm always very cautious about, because I'm in a dark area, I'm behind buildings, and I always, as I leave, I look to both right and left to make sure there's nobody just hiding in the shadows and stuff. But there's now more of that in my life, even. Mm. And I do know that there are a lot of people who are just making sure that, especially around these areas where gay and lesbian people especially meet, that there is some kind of safety plan in place for them. And I really, truly hope that people are taking this seriously, that, you know, it's a good idea, no matter who you are, to make sure that if you're in areas that are a little more sketchy in Salt Lake City, to perhaps act differently than if you were in your neighborhood.
But this isn't just a Salt Lake City problem.
Correct.
Again, one of these attacks occurred in American Fork. Right. M. Yashde.
I think that's a difficult question about whether or not we change the way we behave, because obviously within safety and things we learn, even in DARE programs in elementary school, you know, we learn about traveling together. But the question of, you know, do you change the way you dress? Do you change the way you wear your hair? I think especially when it comes to signifying that you are gay or gay friendly, you know, do you take off your rainbow shoelaces in high schools, or especially for those members of our trans community, I think feeling like they have to maybe move back into a more normative or normal, I said that in quotes, kind of appearance. I think it's a scary situation to be in, because we're really having to ask ourselves, you know, am I going to stick my neck out and be myself, or am I so unsafe that I can't even express my real identity? Mm. And I think that's a sad, unfortunate side effect of that fear.
Brandy Balkin?
Well, I think that people certainly are having that that moment of self-assessment, and that safety is tantamount, right? People want to be safe. People don't want to be at risk in their own environments, be it, you know, outside of a club that they may choose to go to, or in their neighborhood, or at their place of employment. Right. I mean, people are concerned about that. I do think that it's my hope. It is my very profound hope that the implication is not that people go back into the closet or are not able to live their own authentic lives. I know that fear is a very, very powerful motivator, but I think that as a community, and not just the LGBT community, but as a community in the state of Utah, we have a lot of friends. We have a lot of allies. We have a lot of people who love us, and I think that it's also important to remember that we can create and do create our own safety. And we need to continue down that path. I think that's an important thing to remember.
As a part of the community, there is a significant chunk of the business community, small businesses owned by gays and lesbians, and I'm wondering how they are responding to this attack. Are they looking out for their employers a little bit more or employees a little more closely, or what kinds of safety mechanisms are put into place by businesses?
Well, in particular, I'm the president of the or co-president of the Q Business Alliance, and we are an alliance of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and allied business owners. And I put an underline under allies because we have a lot of ally members who are very concerned about our community. And we are actually putting together a fund for rewards when we see anti-gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender violence, that we can offer up rewards for more information. The police department is having a difficult time mm-hmm. getting people to step forward. So if this is something that these business people can do to entice people to come forward, then this is what we're putting that together for.
Michael Aaron is with us, owner and publisher of Q Salt Lake. Also with us, Brandy Balkin, executive director of Equality Utah, and M. Yashde with the Inclusion Center. We'd like to invite you to join us, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Let's go to the phones, and Brian is joining us. Brian, hello.
Very sympathetic to what's happened to these young men. I think they were all young men. I don't actually know all three cases, but I am curious what your panel thinks the hospital could and should do in the setting of our current privacy laws. I work in healthcare, and I think my guess is that the doctors were pretty constrained by what they can and can't do. And then furthermore, do you want patients to be treated differently than any other assault would have been treated because they're gay? And I try very hard not to do that. I try to treat everybody exactly the same, regardless of, they're victims, regardless of why they were victimized.
Right. Brian, thanks very much. Yeah. Brandy Balkin, go right ahead.
So I think you raise a couple of really good points, and I think that that's one of the things, pointing back to an earlier statement that I think Em made, that it is important for us to figure out all the details. One of the conversations that we had as a community, so after this story broke, different folks from the community who were really concerned about what was happening got together just to sort of have a brainstorming session and to hear each other, which I think is an important piece of moving forward. And one of the things that was brought up in that meeting was, where was the victim advocate for Dane? Where was the person who, could kind of sit with him and have that conversation? And we don't really know, or maybe we do, Michael, but I don't really know if that was offered and denied, or if, because there wasn't an incident report filed at the hospital, a victim advocate wasn't provided for Dane. I think ideally, all people who come into a treatment setting and have obviously been the victim of some sort of violent act mm-hmm. have the opportunity or have someone provided to them to advocate for them. If it's a domestic violence situation or if it's a rape situation or if it's some kind of assault situation, that someone is provided to the victim to say, listen, you're safe here and you can talk about it, and let's make sure that we can proceed in a way that's going to give you the best treatment. And direct response to the caller's question, I don't think that anyone should be treated, quote unquote, differently based on their real or perceived characteristics. I think that everyone deserves the same baseline to good health care. Everyone deserves the same treatment with dignity, etc. I would not ask for and certainly don't expect people to get special treatment based on whatever category we see them in. I think that's stereotyping, actually, and that's not the baseline for good treatment. But I think that every person who is the victim of some kind of assault should have the opportunity to have a victim advocate work with them and create safety for them.
Yashde, you want to add to that?
Oh, well, I think I'm over here nodding my head a lot because I agree with a lot of what Brandy's saying. The idea that, when someone does come in for, let's say, domestic violence or sexual assault, that there are advocates there. And I think to even explain the fact that the advocate is there to tell them what their rights are, what, police officers, if they fill out a crime report, what the police officers will do, what their rights are when they're talking to the police officers, and to really mediate between that and a social worker. I myself was trained as a victim advocate when I lived in Brooklyn. And so knowing all these things, you can just see the power of what it might mean for someone to come in who is the victim of a violent crime. But in no way, I think in this case, we don't know enough about the details to know whether or not something bad happened or if someone was negligent. I think it's more about the circumstances, or I don't even know enough even to say that. Mm-hmm. So
our time is coming to a close. Perhaps I can get each of you to talk about the roadmap from here. Where do we go? What do we learn from these incidents? What do you expect from elected leaders, from police officers, from the broader community? Let's start with Michael Aaron.
I do think the community just expects that we will be treated equally, that that when people are victims of these crimes, that they will actually report these crimes. I think that is a hope. I hope that the police department, that people feel very comfortable with the police department and do come forward. You know, we have heard rumor of potential witnesses. We want them to come forward. I plead with you to please come forward now and get to the police department. And really just to be mindful of each other, to make sure that if you see somebody who you know was attacked, you know, to go to them and see and find out if they're pursuing some kind of mental, you know, their own therapy perhaps, or you know, pursuing finding who did this to them.
M. Yashte.
You know, I think what it comes down to for us is that violence doesn't just start at a violent level, but instead it starts with little things. So the jokes we make or the way that we treat people in a store. And I think that if we were to ask anything of the community, it'd be to become more mindful of the way we're treating other people, the, you know, the words that we're using to describe people, the derogative phrases that we use, to be mindful of the way that we speak to our children about different groups and what we encourage our friends to do or what we encourage our employees to do as far as the way that we treat different people. And I think just to harken back to the TSA, you know, if you see something, say something. I think it's really a matter of allies in any situation standing up and saying, you know, that's rude, that's inappropriate, that's offensive, or, hey, I'm calling the cops. I think all of those things take a lot of bravery and a lot of courage, but I think overall it's worth it to build a safe community.
Mm-hmm. And Brandi Balkin.
You know, I think that, well, I believe that the administration and the police department are taking these incidents very seriously. I think they're putting a lot of time and energy into figuring out who the perpetrators of these crimes were, what the motivations were, and I expect that that will continue. I think that for elected officials, I think there is an opportunity for us to have a conversation about what kind of how we want to address the issue, the core issue of bias, and M talks about our own personal responsibilities in regards to that. But I think that there is an opportunity for us to talk with elected leaders about, you know, what are we doing to address this core bias that allows us to dehumanize other categories of people. And I think that from within the LGBTQ community, we do have an opportunity to talk about how we create our own safety, how we create environments for ourselves and for our friends that that we make sure that we're safe in. And I think that it's always important to be having those conversations.
Brandi Balkin, she's Executive Director of Equality Utah. We also heard from M. Yashte with the Inclusion Center at Westminster College. Michael Aaron, owner and publisher of Q Salt Lake. Thanks so much to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank
and
you.
Thanks also earlier this hour to Deputy Chief Lee Dabrowski from Salt Lake Police Department. You can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. And stay with us. Up next, results from a new index measuring what we Utahns value. But first, we need to take another break. Back in a moment. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. We've been told time and again that Utah is one of the best places in the country to live, but just how do we know that? A new Quality of Life Index released this morning gives us some answers, and joining me now to talk about the findings is Steve Cruz. He's the president of the nonpartisan think tank Utah Foundation. And Steve, thanks so much for coming in.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So this is the first year that you've conducted the Quality of Life Index. What exactly do you mean by quality of life? What does the index measure?
There's different ways to look at quality of life. And what we're trying to do is look at community quality of life, not just to assess someone's own sense of well-being, but how they feel about their community and how it enhances or maybe detracts from their quality of life. And so we did a survey based on a lot of background research to understand what factors matter to people in their communities, came up with 20 factors in five different subgroups, things about the economy, about vital services and infrastructure, social characteristics, cultural and recreational opportunities, and the physical surroundings around us, and asked people to rate what is the quality of each of these items right now on a scale of 1 to 5. And then separately, we asked them, how important are each of these factors? So we can get a sense of which ones matter the most in influencing someone's quality of life.
All right. So let's go through the findings. What do Utahns value the very most?
The five most important items on the list are quality health care, safety and security from crime, air and water quality, public schools, and the availability of good jobs.
And is it in that order?
It is. Yes, it is in that order. And so now those have different ratings in terms of quality. Some of those are successes, and some of those are areas where we need some help. And so right now, of course, with the economy nationally and in Utah struggling to come out of that last recession, jobs ended up as the category that rated the worst in terms of quality. And we have heard a lot of things about Utah's economy being better than the national economy. But for the last couple of years, our job losses were actually higher than the rest of the nation. We're starting to recover a little bit more this year, where our job growth was better than the nation. But you know, everybody's talking openly now about a double dip recession, and there's quite a possibility that we're heading into another one. So this is a big concern for people.
So yes, that economic reality hitting people where they think, you know, that the state is ranked in terms of quality of life.
Hey, people have their own experiences that may be different than what they see in the news. And so far and away, the jobs category rated as the worst in quality right now. And that's something that in future years we'll probably see the quality rate higher when more people have jobs. But there is also this long-term underlying concern that jobs in Utah don't pay as well as in other places people have lived.
Talk about public safety. Earlier in the hour, we've been talking about a recent rash of gay bashings in the state. Overall, how are Utahns feeling about safety issues? Do they feel safe in this community and in this state?
You know, first of all, listening to the last half hour of your show, it's very disturbing to think about the concept of curb checking or something like that happening to anybody in our community. It's just an awful example of the violence that can happen. We have in Utah a reputation, and it's true, for generally low rates of violent crime. There's one category of violent crime where Utah does rate high, and that is rape. And there's a lot of theories about why that is so. I think the strongest theory is probably we have a high proportion of young men in our population, and those are the perpetrators generally. But in other categories of violent crime, we're quite low, but we're a little bit high in property crime, stolen cars, breaking and entering, things like that. But overall, our crime rates have been coming down as they have been in the rest of the country for the last decade. And so the trend is pretty good. But we do have these few problem areas. But mostly people feel fairly safe in their communities. It wasn't the highest rated in terms of quality. It didn't make the top five. But it was in that section of things that were above average for quality and above average for importance.
Speaking with Steve Cruz, president of the Utah Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank, this morning they released their first Quality of Life Index. So, how are you thinking about quality of life in the state of Utah? If you have any questions or comments, please join us. 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Steve Cruz, let's turn to education. And this is perennially in the polls. Utahns care about public schools. What did you find?
Oh, yeah. This is always an issue. We do a lot of polling during election years. We do our Utah Priorities Project when there's a gubernatorial election. And public education always ends up either as issue number one or in the top three. The economy kind of pushed it to number three last time. But Education is really broken out into two pieces here. We've got higher education and then K through 12 public schools. And higher ed ends up as one of our success stories. It's one of the areas that is important in terms of quality. It ranked number 6 in importance. And so it's number 5 in quality, number 6 in importance. So it's high quality, high importance. But public schools was below the line. It wasn't the worst in terms of quality, but it was in that quadrant where things show up on our graph as being high importance but lower quality. And when we ask people the open-ended questions, what's the most important thing that elected leaders could do in this state to improve your quality of life, they said improve public schools was the most popular answer.
Did that surprise you at all?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. There's always concerns about public education in the state. We have a high birth rate, a lot of kids, a very young population, and it's difficult in this small economy to afford the kind of tax revenues to support education the way that most parents want to see it happen, with smaller class sizes and things like that.
Mm. Your quality of life index shows that Utahns highly value air and water quality.
Yes, they do. And it ends up being about average in terms of quality, but it's close to that area of concern where it's poking maybe just a little below the average line. And, you know, we, of course, see that when we have our winter inversions and our summer inversions. And this valley here in Salt Lake traps a lot of smog. And water quality is less of a concern, I think, from other surveys we've done. People are more satisfied about water, but satisfied about the quality, but concerned about the quantity available, especially when we have droughts. But the air quality is a big concern, and that's one of the areas that we would put in that section of public policy action needs to pay attention to this and address it.
Hmm. Let's turn to health care. That was one of the top 5 categories. What did you find?
Yes, it was one of the most important, but it also rated as pretty high quality. It's one of those areas where we consider these success stories as places where public policy should try to preserve the quality that is there, or to not at least interfere with what's going on. There's certainly issues like in the rest of America with affordability. But overall, we rank better than the average state in terms of our healthcare system, and we rank very high in the top 5 in terms of the health of our population, and even when you adjust for age. And so that's one of those areas where we're doing pretty well. You know, what I wanted to say, because we're probably going to run out of time here in a minute, but one of the reasons we wanted to do this report is because we keep hearing statements about how Utah's tops in the nation, or in the top 5 in the nation, as a place to live or a place to run a business. And yet we know that Utah's pretty unique, and we know that people here value things maybe differently than folks in other states. And so we wanted to get at some of those social factors as well. You know, how, because you hear anecdotally people move back here because family's here, because they were born and raised here, maybe they've got that connection through the LDS church or something like that, and it brings them back to Utah if they've left the state, or it brings folks from other states here. Mm-hmm. And so we asked people, you know, how important those factors are. And it's pretty interesting to see what the results are. The availability of spiritual and religious activities, for example, was the thing that rated the highest in terms of quality. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that available, but it was below the line in terms of importance. People felt that it really wasn't all that important to their quality of life. At least it was a little below average. And then on the social aspect, you know, having family nearby, it was above average in terms of quality, but it was way down there in terms of importance. And so, and then we asked things about other social factors, the extent to which people support and help each other. That was considered one of our strengths, high quality, fairly high importance. But then the question of people accepting of differences, and this can relate to your last segment on the show this morning. Do people accept differences in society? That was rated as pretty important. It was above average in importance, but low in quality. And so that's one of the areas that we need to work on as a society.
Interesting. Any self-respecting index has to have a number attached. And I believe that the number this year is 77 out of 100. What does this mean? Does this mean that we're doing okay? Does this mean that we have a lot of improvement to make in this in Utah?
It means there is some improvement to make, and it will become more valuable as we go forward over time. We plan to do this survey every 2 years to track our quality of life over time and to see how it's changing. Because in a growing state, it will change as more people move here and as our population changes. And so 77.2 is the initial quality of life score for Utah. You can think of that on a scale of 1 to 100. So you might say we get a C plus, 77% of perfection. And yet we don't know how other states would rank on this scale because this is a unique index for Utah we created just for Utah. But what we want to do is compare against ourselves as the years go by and see how that changes and whether it improves.
Steve Cruz, he's the president of the Utah Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. And we'll have a link to your quality of life index on our website, kcpw.org. Steve, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
City Views is a production of KCPW News with help from Eric Ray and Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. You can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org or check us out on Facebook and on Twitter. Coming up tomorrow, bringing a little bit of rural living to the city, we'll have a discussion about urban farming in Salt Lake County. I hope you'll join me for that discussion tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.